Lowe's knows you've got a job to do, and we help get it done. With the MyLowe's Pro Rewards program, eligible members save more. With volume discounts on qualifying orders through a quote of $2,000 or more. Join for free today. Lowe's. We help you save. Offer can't be combined with any other discount, contract, and or special pricing. Exclusions, more terms, and restrictions apply. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to a Slash Filmcast bonus episode. Today it's just me, Devendra Hardwar, and I'll be chatting about Children of Men for the movie's 10-year anniversary. So joining me today is Anthony Ha, senior writer from TechCrunch.
Thanks for having me.
And Anthony, you're also a sci-fi writer, so I'd love to have your take on this film. And also Dwayne DeFreitas, my friend from college and co-host at the Drill Down podcast. Hey, Dwayne.
Hey, what's going on?
And Dwayne's also a sci-fi writer, so I'm pretty outmatched here when it comes to people who know what they're talking about when it comes to fiction and narrative and stuff, but I'll try, because Children of Men is one of my favorite films ever. Probably my favorite. It kind of switches between Children of Men and Old Boy, depending on the mood in the day or whatever, but it's definitely my favorite Cuarón film. And yeah, the more I think about it, it's a film I've always loved. But it's particularly relevant today as we're approaching, the presidency of Donald Trump, the insanity of everything else happening around the world. There have been a lot of articles talking about how prescient this movie was. And yeah, I just wanted to talk about that and the legacy of the film and, yeah, see if we can learn anything from it. And yeah, maybe it'll teach us something moving forward, too. So first question for you guys, what is your relationship with this film? Do you remember when you first saw it?
Yes, totally. I was actually with a friend who's actually he's a PA and like kind of junior cinematographer for some of the HBO productions like Boardwalk Empire. But we were in the Pavilion Cinema in Brooklyn, and I think we basically saw a bunch of movies that day.
The dearly departed Pavilion Cinema. It's dead. I can walk to it now, but they killed it at the end of October, unfortunately.
Soon to be replaced by a Nighthawk.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was the one deep in on Prospect Park West, and we sat there and we saw the film, and you know that was the last thing that we saw all day. It was the only one that we caught all the way through, because when you're movie jumping the way we had been, you kind of just watch bits and pieces, and even though there was stuff to watch after that, we just had to leave because it was like
too real. The impact of this movie.
Yeah, it was pretty stunning, and. There's just so, like, once you finish watching it that first time, unless I guess you're some sort of like super genius, there's so much to continue to unpack in your mind that I was really pleased to have someone there who was also, you know, focused on storytelling to be able to actually discuss it with. I didn't know who to talk to. I felt like I had just experienced this thing and nobody knew about it.
And Anthony, so how did you, when did you, do you remember seeing this film for the first time and how it impacted you?
I do. I mean, actually, the first thing I remember is I just remember being incredibly excited about it before it came out, you know, since Cuarón had done Harry Potter and E2 Mama before then, two like incredibly different films. So we're like, what is like his next step going to be?
And films telling us that he was a pretty talented dude. Yeah, somebody to watch out for.
But other than that, you couldn't predict anything. Mm-hmm. You were like, this movie could be anything. And I remember watching the trailer a bunch, which I mean, I think you know, like in some ways that the trailer was maybe a little bit off for the film because it promised a much more uplifting film than maybe the one we
got. There was Sigur Rós in the trailer. Like, they really didn't know how to market this movie because the trailer was more hopeful than the movie seemed.
Right.
Yeah.
I will say, I mean, it certainly worked in my case that it made me excited to see it. And I went.
Yes.
And then I felt like I got like hit by a truck. And I remember like just, you know, I think it was a movie that it really took me a while to come around to because I sort of admired the talent of it. And I think particularly at the time, just found, you know, the style, the visual style, like incredibly interesting. But I think just like the bleakness of it, I think hit, like made it really difficult for me to really love it for a while. And I think in recent years, as people, you know, continue to talk about it and then just even revisiting it again for this podcast, I mean, I just realized how amazing it is.
Yeah.
It's that bleakness that really excited me when I saw it actually. Cause well, all right. So you're talking to a guy who goes to Seattle every year for the holidays and is excited about the weather. But
right, right.
I was watching it and I found that sort of drabness, that sort of low color palette, it allowed me to focus on characters more, and it reminded me that that this is kind of the world they're living in. It's kind of unclear. Why? I mean, you're in England, so you know it's going to be foggy. At the same time, you've got this future setting, and we know that things like air pollution are going to get worse, and yada, yada, yada. So it just seemed to kind of fit with the setting they were making, that things aren't sunny and happy. Mm-hmm. And even through the movie, through the end of the movie, when they're just sitting in this fog, and all they can see, the only thing they see in the sky are like F-35s going by and then bombing something, and the explosion from that, right? So it's like they're mired down by this heaviness, and that heaviness is even in the air. It's in everything around them, and that's kind of how I feel sometimes when I'm in a situation that I think is hard. And let's face it, their entire life situation, their setting was pretty hard, bleak, you know. So yeah, I think there was something to that.
But yeah, and as you guys are talking about this, I've been thinking about it. I actually don't remember when I first saw this movie. I was definitely excited for it. And I was still working in IT at Amherst College at the time, so I saw it in our little Cinemark there, where we had to see all the movies, so we all got pretty familiar with that place. So, strangely, like, I can't remember my first experience watching this movie, even though I know I was very excited for it. I saw the trailers as well. Cuarón was somebody I had my eye on as well. And I was just really into watching, you know, crazy new styles of film at that point. That was before we did the Slash Filmcast. This movie came out in, what, 2006, right? And we started podcasting about movies in 2008, late 2007. So, yeah, it was a couple years until we were even doing something like that. But strangely, the movie felt like, I guess it hit me in a way that it felt like it was always with me. It's sort of like when I read 1984 for the first time. It was stunning and revelatory, but then it also felt like it was always something that I kind of felt in tune with even before I had read it. So my relationship with this film has been pretty close from the start. Yeah,
there's like a little bit of controversy.
Oh, sorry,
go ahead. I was just gonna ask if this is a film that you actually rewatch pretty frequently.
Oh yes, since then, like, and I think that's part of the thing too, is I've seen it so many times. Like, I watch it probably several times a year. It's a movie that's always clicked with me a lot, and you guys are talking about how bleak it is. It is bleak, but it's not like relentlessly bleak, right? It's not like Requiem for a Dream or something, or even The Road, which is another like big.
The Road is the bleakest film.
Those are our bars.
Yes, yeah.
Sure. If The Road is your film for bleak, is your bar for bleak? Then like, yeah, nothing.
That's
this is
like,
clearly
that's
like
the end of the
like Wizard of Oz.
Meter. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, so I like my sci-fi a little bleak, but with a tinge of hope. You got to have that hope in there. The hope can't be everything, but it has to be, you know, it has to be an important part of the story. And I think even back then, you know, we were still dealing with the war in Iraq. We were dealing with refugee issues all over the place. We knew by that point that we'll have an environmental crisis coming. And everything this movie talked about really resonated then. What's scary, though, is that flash forward 10 years, it almost seems like we've reached the future of this movie twice as fast, right? This movie takes place 10 years from now, but so much of the imagery and so much of the things we're seeing and the propaganda in the film, and even the... we're not seeing refugee fences and encampments in the UK yet, But it doesn't seem like we're too far from that. I've seen a lot of, like, people have been tweeting a lot of images of, like, the people, the vans who are picking up refugees or hunting down illegal refugees over there. And just the idea that that's so similar is kind of scary. So is that something you guys have noticed as well?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the thing about seeing it in 2006 was, again, I was seeing with my buddy Evan, and he had actually gone down in 2005 to Louisiana after Katrina.
Yep.
And Katrina was still fresh in, I think, most of the nation's mind in 2006. Mm-hmm. That happened in August, and this movie came out in August 2005, and this came out in 2006. And that kind of, you know, the refugee situation, it had happened in America already, right? There was that whole thing that happened in the stadium in Louisiana, and people had to leave the stadium. It was a nightmare hell scenario, and you had the refugees going over to Texas and into Mississippi and all these places. Kanye West was talking about how the world doesn't care about, you know, people of color. And when you see this film, what really got me was that the refugee issue wasn't one of, like, these people from this area are refugees. It's the refugees look like everybody, right? There were, you know, people of European descent, Middle Eastern descent, South Asian descent, Asian descent, African descent. Everybody was in these boxes. And so it's almost like, what made you an okay person, a person who would walk around and be normal and all the rest of it? Because the regular citizens of the UK, they also come from all colors. So there was this kind of arbitrary line about who got affected and who didn't. And that to me was, like, the most frightening part. Like, what side of this law are you on where you can be put in a metal cage and just be background noise for somebody living their life versus, you know, being a bowler hat and a nice coat and walking around and living your life? Like, what that kind of confusion was a real big thing. And today, you know, when we think about what's going on when it comes to Brexit and so on, people are anti-immigration and stuff like that. There seems to be a slightly more defined, let's call it, color palette between who wants to separate themselves from whom.
Right.
And that overt kind of focus.
You're saying the film was even too hopeful in its perception, in its portrayal of bigotry. Like, the real world is actually worse because it is a lot of, like, the white Brits who don't want that.
Kind of. Well, I think with the real world, right now you can see things coming because there's a certain type of person that wants to kind of build certain exclusionary practices around law and legitimacy. In that film, what was scary was that there's no way to tell who is, you know, locked out or allowed in. And that arbitrariness made it so that at the end, you know, Theo, the Clive Owen character, he's readily admitted to this camp and no one's like, hey, why are you here? Well, what's wrong? What, you know, what's keeping you here? It wasn't like, oh, he should be a British person, whatever. They're just like, oh, he's another guy because he doesn't have his papers, so to speak. He's another Fuji. And that's a little frightening because if you think about Britain as a nation of, like, the same people in the same place with the same language, clearly he's part of that history on some level, but not. He's been expelled, so to speak. He's been excommunicated from his own people. And that's a little strange and frightening because there's just no way to pin down what makes you a Fuji or not, you know? So that was weird.
And that's actually, yeah, that's something we're still seeing today. I think in every country, right? Here in the U.S. too, like the conversation around people who are here illegally, even if they've been here for many years or decades, and how does that really separate them from, you know, a natural born citizen? These are all things we're still dealing with. Anthony, you were trying to bring up an issue too, I think.
Oh, no, I agree, though, that it definitely, it's interesting because I think I hadn't rewatched the film in a few years, and I'd kind of almost forgotten that was such a big element of the film.
Yeah.
But, and you watch it now, and there is this element of, like, wow, if you made this film now, it'd almost feel too on the nose, and, like, you would say, oh, well, this is, you know, such a film of the moment that it's not going to, you know, resonate at all, you know, mm-hmm. 10 years from now, but clearly this is something that continues to be important. I think the other thing that really struck me was how much is that it contextualized, that it may seem weird, like, if you talk about it in an abstract way of, like, oh, like, it's a movie about, you know, this high concept about infertility, but then there's also this, you know, refugee situation going on at the same time, but it does a really good job of tying them together, mm-hmm. and, you know, showing how, you know, other political factors you know, that when we have situations like this, they don't occur in a vacuum, but they're, you know, often being sort of exacerbated and by other things.
For sure. Yes, I totally agree. I think what's beautiful about this movie is how, I guess, everything comes together, right? This isn't a very long movie, but it paints its ideas kind of broadly in a way, and it wraps it all together just really, really beautifully. What I love about this film is that it doesn't even waste much time with setup, right? And with context, because there's so much going on in the background of this world. To really understand Children of Men, you kind of have to watch it a few times and not just pay attention to the story in the foreground, but what's also happening in the background, because that's the only way you're going to get some of the backstory of what's happening here. I love the scene where Theo is caught first by the fishes, and he's in the room that's just plastered with newspapers, which is just a brilliant way of conveying, I think, the history of what's going on there, right? Because you see the climate issues, you see issues in America dealing with nuclear fallout. I just remember some of the headlines there. The movie is
there's a mushroom cloud, and they've got this this news thing going on, like, you know, America, New York has a mushroom cloud over it, you know, Berlin, Paris, they're showing all these places.
It's like a 5-second clip, like while they're introducing a news thing, and only Britain stands alone as like the one country that can survive all this. But what I love about that clip too, by the way, is that it's really, really short. The mushroom cloud is there on the screen for less than a second. But, you know, Americans who had just experienced 9/11 or something, that's like an even more intense image. You don't need more than half a second to really convey the impact of that.
Yeah, and that's also interesting because just politically speaking, mm-hmm. one of the things that I think Dick Cheney said on like Sunday news shows was, we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud over you know, someplace in America. So that resonates right there. On top of that, the way Karan uses the news in addition to the background, the cinematography, to tell us a story without the exposition is pretty powerful.
A really forced way, because we've seen that a lot too in sci-fi movies where it's just newscasters. Right. It's people in actual
breaking
real
everything
newscasters
down.
Issue.
Yeah, they'll use real newscasters, mm-hmm. or they'll have some person who's just unaware of what's going on. And this is a typical story plot mechanism. The new guy, like Luke, has to be taught everything. And so through Luke, we get taught everything in the Star Wars universe. In this case, we don't really have that. We have a whole bunch of kind of drab, almost faceless people staring at TV, staring at it with them, or they're on a bus or whatever. But it's really like the story of the universe is being told through things like newsfeed. Like, it's very mundane, I guess is the way I would mm-hmm. say it. In addition to the bleakness we've talked about, there's a mundane nature of telling you about the world that we're in. And because it's so, you know, blasé, like, oh, okay, whatever, it sneaks up on you. It's insidious that this place is so bleak. And it's only kind of at that moment where the outside world of the refugees merges with the foreground uh-huh. of the plot line with our characters. And that is when he decides that he's going to take this trip and go into the refugee camp. It's only at that moment that we're really confronted with like the brutal treatment of these people mm-hmm. and how inhumane this part of Britain is. And especially interesting that it's Britain, considering that we think of Britain as one of the most civilized places in the world, that they could be treating people like this is kind of anathema to a 21st century human, you know, person
for
watching
sure.
a film.
And that's actually, yeah, so that was weird. I love the sequence where we, you know, Theo goes to meet his cousin in the really affluent, rich part of the city. And the like jarring switch, right? It's what's the song? Throne of the Crimson King, I think, is playing. It's like he's entering there. And just like seeing that world, right? The people who, it's a clean environment. It's so lush and green. There are zebras in the park, guys. And I think there's a camel, yeah. too. Like
it's like Zamunda in Coming to America, right?
For sure. Like it's the land of plenty, walled away from, like, you know, everybody else. That whole sequence, I love that we go from the real world to the heightened, like, really affluent world where, you know, works of art are just being kept. I love the one line where Theo's talking to his cousin about something like Madrid, right? It would have been a real loss for art. And Theo's like, yeah, not to mention people if we had lost this thing.
And what's really funny about that is that you see that, like, the Michelangelo, yeah, the leg is broken, but they've saved it, which gives it a bit more realness. But what's really cool is that, you know, when you look at Michelangelo's David and you look at it in its place now, it's in this little cupola. It's surrounded by these columns and this beautiful marble and this art.
With guard dogs, too. That's right, the imagery. He's walking it. Right. Like, the art is not for everybody. It's for the people who can get in.
But I guess what I was also going to say is that in this staging of Michelangelo's David, you see it in a stark space. There's kind of like these cubicle walls surrounding it. It's got like a window behind it. The sky is just white. There's no context to this art. When he's got the Picasso behind him, there's no context to that art. And that's so weird because as much as the art is beautiful, it can't really be appreciated outside of context. And yet there it is. And on top of all that, you know, you've got this kid sitting down there next to them when they're eating there, presumably his nephew, and he's got the same screen time fascination that we worry about with children today that was 10 years ago, a year before the iPhone had come out.
Yeah.
Right.
A year before the iPhone, definitely years before we realized that would have been a phenomenon too, like that everybody would be into it. That scene always kind of, it seemed like a weird commentary in gaming at that point. And then flash forward 10 years, it's like, my God, like, he's even doing, like, screen gesture stuff on that little gaming system.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he doesn't complete the actor was, by that way.
What's that?
Say again?
The actor playing the kid was Ed Westwick, Chuck Bass from Gossip Girl, which
what?
I just think is hysterical. Yeah, that's him.
Not everybody watches Gossip Girl, Anthony, but that is a wonderful reference.
That is.
Here to help. Let's.
Yeah. For me, it was just weird because of the idea that he's surrounded by all this incredible art. It has no context. And so to him, it means nothing, which is why he's looking at a game instead of this Picasso behind him. So that's all I wanted to say about that.
Specifically that it's Guernica and, like, you know, one of the most, like, horrifying, like, moving political pieces of art. And it just sits there while people, you know, eat their lunch.
Eat a really, really fancy lunch, too. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the kind of meal that he couldn't even think about affording, even though he's not a man who's, like, hard up right now or anything. He's clearly not in a financial place he wants to be, which is why he takes the meeting with Julia to begin with, right? Because the idea of $5,000 or whatever, 5,000 pounds or whatever he'd get for dealing with this refugee situation. So it was a striking. I think it's exactly what you said. The idea that we're not having a lot of exposition or discussion, but through the way this stuff is staged, we're seeing that the world is really out of balance. It's really out of whack, but it's out of whack in these subtle ways that could have prepped up on you.
Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting too is, like, we see it as out of balance. And what's funny to me is, like, just watching Theo just, like, live with it, right? He's walking by the, you know, the refugees chained up, and really horrific things happening to these people, right? You just... I think it's a really interesting thought to have right now, like, as we're approaching a really, really difficult and contentious political climate for the next few years. I wonder how easy it is for people to just kind of go on with their lives. Yeah, it'll get a little harder. You know, things will get a little more inconvenient. But if you're middle class in a way, right, you can ignore a lot of those things and just live on. And the entire story with this movie really is about his story of him, like, being
kind of keep calm and carry on.
Well, not even keeping calm and carry on, but it's also, like, looking up and giving a damn and doing something. I love in the there's a great Vulture retrospective that just went up, which kind of prompted this recording as well by Abraham Reisman, and he got some great stuff from Cuarón and a bunch of the folks too. And what's interesting is that Cuarón isn't like, he doesn't seem too excited about the fact that he predicted so much stuff, because this movie comes out of a lot of research and just him looking at trends and him looking at things that were actually happening at the time. You know, we could have seen that a lot of this stuff was coming. And there's one great quote from him that's he says, "What's really relevant now is to stop being complacent." And yeah, that's a wonderful takeaway from this film. I think probably more important than ever. And I mean, in a weird way, too, it reminds me of it's very Rogue One in that way, too, right? We're going to see a lot of stories of rebels and people trying to do something about it. In a weird way, that's something young adult fiction has been doing for the past couple of years, right? It's like every year we'd have several dystopian stories coming up. So I almost feel like, in a way, pop culture was preparing for some sort of weird ideological battle, right? That's Hunger Games. The entire point, of this movie, I think, the greater thematic point is very much what Hunger Games is doing. Because that was also a series where, it's a people fighting the oppressive government, but even the rebels couldn't be trusted. And I always found that an interesting aspect of that story, too.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I think the thing that, I was going to say just that I think, I mean, one of the things that makes Children Men a bit different from some of these other films, though, is that I think it's possible for people of a lot of different stripes to maybe see, like, I, you know, like, we've definitely, like, you know, seen, like, conservatives talk about themselves as if they're the rebellion, and we could have an argument on whether that's really supported by the text. But I mean, I think that, like, that sometimes, you know, that science fiction is political allegory. Sometimes it can be in this very broad way, like Rogue One. Or, I mean, the thing about, like, Children of Men is that, yes, there's sort of these broader ideas, but it also is, like, has, like, very specific politics. And so I think, you know, unlike some of these other films, I don't think, you know, wears the its politics on its sleeves, I think, a little bit more clearly than something like Hunger Games, which I think is political, but also can be read in a number of different ways.
That's true. Like, if you're very broad, then, yeah, you could see yourself as the one being oppressed pretty easily.
Right. And when you look at this also, what's interesting that differentiates it from Hunger Games, Maze Runner, you know, Divergent, all this stuff, is that those scenarios happen in a time where we're either very old people or we're long dead. Whereas this film, I think Alfonso, you know, his writer Sexton says that this was an inflection point. The future wasn't ahead of us. We were living through it. And when I look at the film, what's interesting is that, you know, again, it's kind of like you see things are off from our perspective, but they're not off from these people's perspective, because things have been turning to this kind of off and askew manner in a slow enough way so that where it is at the point that we're seeing the film, everyone's adjusted, right? To the point where even when we're looking at, you know, Jasper and Theo talking, Jasper's like, hey, what do you think it is with the people not being able to get pregnant? He's like, well, it doesn't really matter anymore, because it's such a regular thing now. It's such a piece of it that he's not even worried about where it comes from. It's just a fact of life now. And what's really weird about that is how he's so comfortable with the fact that the world is effectively dying.
Right.
Right. Right. And so we're seeing this world where it's the slow death, as opposed to, like, in the Hunger Games, there was some war or some post-apocalyptic event or some kind of huge inflection that happened, whether it's aliens invading or whatever. There's, like, a moment where you can say things changed. And what's the craziest thing about Children of Men is that we're living through that change, and it's going to take decades, but there's almost nothing you can do about it, right? Mm-hmm. Well, politically, there's probably something you can do about it, but no one's willing to do anything about it. And so people have to suffer for decades to get through this change, which ends up in the death of everything, which is more depressing, I think, than the Hunger Games and the other things. But I do think you're right in terms of giving younger audiences the idea that, like, not everything is perfect. If we don't stay vigilant, things can come out in a terrible way.
Yeah,
I do think that's helpful.
I do, in a weird way, it does seem like this. This movie also preceded all of those franchises too, and the whole, like, YA explosion, or the post-apocalyptic YA explosion. And I almost feel like those things are a response to the inflection point that they were talking about here. And this film wasn't really, like, it was well received critically, but it didn't really make much money. It was mostly ignored by the Oscars.
It was
really
a flop in the theater.
It was a complete flop. And yeah, the Oscars also didn't give it much love either. And it's interesting, just I guess when something is too far ahead of the time, people can't even really tell how valuable it is, except for the true fans of something like this. It was also, this movie makes me think of Blade Runner in a way, too.
Yes.
Just aesthetically, like how it builds the world, how lived in the entire world is. But I think what makes it even a more important film than Blade Runner is that, there's some great sci-fi themes in that movie. That is also one of my favorite movies ever made. But those themes are a little more, I don't know, a little more universal. Like, there are more themes of identity and being and what really makes us human. And there's no real urgency to that story. And I think that's partially why that
mission,
movie...
There's a bit of a mission urgency in that story, which I think parallels nicely with this one. Like, he's got the mission. He's got to take out these six people.
Yes, yes. And the replicants have a timeline. Otherwise, you know, they're going to... So they have a sense of urgency. But I've also... In a way, I've also always felt like Blade Runner was the replicant's story. It just, it always seemed more on their side, even though they were doing bad things. But yeah, this movie gives us that same sort of world, but also gives us, I think, a lot more to chew on and to reflect. It reflects our own world in a much greater way, for sure.
Yeah, because that comparison also brings up the, you know, the one of the things I was wondering about is, you know, Blade Runner was this movie that came out and, like, you know, didn't do that well initially. But then suddenly, you know, 20, 30 years later, you look around and realize that that's sort of the default. When a science fiction movie wants to have, like, depict the future, the Blade Runner future is kind of like the default. And I'm curious if Children of Men will have or has had that kind of influence, because it seems like to me it's this movie that in some ways has, you know, like suddenly everyone's talking about it, everyone sort of acknowledges it as sort of this classic, and yet I don't necessarily see a lot of films that have followed in its footsteps.
I think a lot of things now. Go ahead.
I was just saying, I think maybe at this point where people recognize it, where they're kind of slapped in the face with the reality that Caron pushed in, we might begin seeing films in the next 3 or so years that build on this sort of thing. But I think with Blade Runner 2, we didn't see a lot of things that kind of directly felt inspired by Blade Runner until after Blade Runner was considered this cult classic and then a large classic. I think that when you look at Children of Men, I'm not sure it was ever truly a cult classic. I don't remember like a fan following that I could like latch onto and get there. It was kind of an underground following. Now that where it's more underground than cult is normally. And now that we're in a place where you could see the themes from this movie on their face in our real lives, I do think people will be taking inspiration from this, especially because not only was the film, you know, the narration, the narrative of the film done in a very interesting way that ties into today, I think it also pioneered some really powerful and difficult techniques that keep it very modern, even 10 years later, because people haven't been able to do things like that amazing, and I use that word literally, automobile scene where Julianne Moore's character, Julian, dies, or that incredible cinema verite kind of thing where they're running around avoiding tank fire, right? Like as if they're in Dresden during the bombing or something.
Yeah. I mean, we have seen movies do like that particular scene, the army scene. We've seen movies do that, and I've seen even movies like the freaking Fright Night remake try to recreate a very similar car chase, except that did it mostly with CG.
Still a great scene
right. In the Fright Night remake.
Realness of it is what I like so much.
It's not CG.
It's less CG.
There is some CG in this movie, but yeah, that whole you just go look up like how the car scene was done in Children of Men. But basically, they had this whole like rig up for the camera that was swinging around the car. Actors had to like dodge out of place. And it was like I believe sitting above the roof too. Like it was, if you look at the rig that they built for the car, it's just like sitting up there. So it's a physical camera that's moving around, which is even more insane given like how little space they had to work with. And it's not like, I don't think they were shooting digitally at that point. Like everyone was still kind of shooting with film. So yeah, it's a major accomplishment. Back to what we were saying.
I didn't
saying.
Even notice it though. That's the craziest part about it. Like
yeah.
I didn't notice that was I knew that shot, I was surprised and appalled. Also because, you know, one of the top billed people is dying so early in the film.
Within
and all these things
minutes
happening.
Of the movie, that's kind of amazing.
So that happens. And what gets me about that is later on reading about it, I read about, you know, if you notice, this scene is whatever. This scene is incredible because it's 200 or whatever seconds of just movement. But what got me, and I know that there's some criticism about that scene and how, you know, it's overdone. I feel like in film, a lot of the time, we're so used to the whiz-bang, or like, you know, the Star Wars prequels with the laser guns and the spaceships and the shooting, that when you see something as a sort of like, again, to use the word mundane, as one person getting shot and everyone having to deal with that one person getting shot and having to focus on the tragedy of that one person getting shot and not being able to take your eyes off of that scene, that's what kind of pulled me in dramatically to the film in a way that I might have otherwise kind of been like, oh, okay, she died.
I mean, that's right? The entire point of this movie, right? Is like, it's balancing, you know, the joy and tragedy of living. And that whole scene like encapsulates the movie for me, right? Because they start off, they're playing the game, the ping pong ball game, and I don't think have they ever admitted if that was completely practical or not. Like I think Cuaron was being a little coy about it, but you know that scene, everyone's having fun. Like Julian and Theo are kind of
flirting
in a way. Yeah, they're flirting. Yeah, right. Everything seems good. And what I love about that scene is how the horror just kind of escalates slowly. Like, oh, everyone's happy. Then you pan to the front and flaming car, and they're like, oh, shit. And then, you know, for some reason, Chiwetel Ejiofor's character takes a while to start backing up. But then he starts backing up, and, like, yeah, it escalates from there. That gunshot where Julianne Moore's character, where she's actually shot, is it happens so quickly. And there's a little blood on the camera when that happens, too. That happens also in the the whole war sequence at the end, which was a mistake. Can you imagine that?
Apparently, yeah.
Yeah. But a beautiful.
Nobody can hear him scream. Right. Well, that thing, that, so that scene where she gets shot, mm-hmm. to me, it, like you said, it makes the movie for you. It makes the movie for me in another way. I agree with what you're saying. But also, you know, she gets shot, and obviously the blood is happening. And what happens is Theo, who's just reconnected with her, does his damnedest to save her life.
Yeah.
He leans forward. You know, there's clearly these bad guys coming. You know, he kicks the door and the bad guys kind of get pushed over. But then as the guy's driving backward, he's out of seatbelt. This car could – anything could happen. And he's trying to do everything to stop the bleeding, to save her life, this woman that he once loved. And we didn't even really know the story about why he once loved her, but we believe it because of what's going on here. And when we later learn that she told Key to trust him, we believe in that trust – because of the way he tried to save her life,
mm-hmm.
I think. He doesn't get many scenes with Julianne Moore, right? He doesn't get much super interaction. But in that one car sequence, however long it took, he basically shows that, you know, she may not have been his girlfriend or wife then, but she was his one.
For sure.
And that's the kind of relationship that I think mm-hmm. a lot of people have actually experienced, right? Like, you may not be with this person now, but they are your person. And he lost that person in that way, and he was powerless to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as if once he realizes the true horror, which is that, you know, Luke, the guy driving, the true horror is that as Luke is backing up, the reason why he took that moment to back up and the reason why all this happened is because he planned it.
Yep.
Right. So there's this horror that just kind of keeps on building out of that one moment. And it's really something.
What I love about that scene, too, just the windshield, just like watch the windshield, which I think that had to be a digital effect. But like the slow cracking. Until it all like explodes, like it's poetic in a way of like how it all comes together.
You're in this shit now, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Like what happens when it breaks, right?
And what I love about go ahead, Anthony.
I was going to say that the other, not to keep praising this one scene, but one of the things I love about it too is I realized that's the moment where it's not like been a boring film by any means but that's when for the rest of the movie, like you're just on edge the whole time. And like
it becomes a chase movie. Tone,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, and also because I think you realize that like, that he's not going to give you sort of the normal signals of like, this scene is like a fun scene. This is an action scene, but that one can shade very quickly into the other. And I mean, I think from a plot perspective, that ends up being the case that a lot of times things are fine. And they go wrong multiple times in that way. But like, that's the thing that sort of makes that possible. And just like, you are so like in it for the rest of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really takes you. It really takes you. I mean, I'm just going to just super agree with Anthony right there. Cause from that moment, I'm like, anything can happen.
Yeah.
I must not take my eyes away from the screen. And that the way they shot it helps you not want to take your eyes away from the screen because you're blinking while that camera keeps on moving. The human eye doesn't work like that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. that was discussed in this other article on IO9 or I'm sorry.
The AV Club, I think.
The AV Club, exactly. Mm-hmm. About how your eye doesn't even work in this sort of super way. But because there's so much information, you're afraid to miss it. And because you're afraid to miss it, you're on the edge of your seat. And that's because you're not going to get the normal cues like the music becoming suddenly dramatic or anything like that. You're really there. So it was Anthony, you're spot on.
It's definitely the shit just got real moment of this movie. But what I also found interesting too is like up until that point, pretty much every single scene we've seen of Theo is him just like getting drunk, right? At the beginning, he is he's getting coffee. He pours a little liquor on it. Explosion. He goes to work. He gets out of work. And then he goes to visit Jasper, right? And they get high and they drink. Luke buys him several beers at the bar because after he agrees to do it, right? Everyone's like, oh, he's just doing it for the money. This guy doesn't really care about what he's doing. And that's also what he's making sure. And even in the car, he has his liquor, you know, and he takes a nap and Key calls him a drunk, right? And then
and
at
that's
that point,
so interesting.
Yeah,
sorry,
after that point of the car chasing, it's like, yeah, things get insane. He tries to have a smoke and he just breaks down. And yeah, his entire modus operandi changes after that.
So I was really glad they didn't have a scene where he was like just pouring the bottle out. They ramped it down and they made it clear that he was an alcoholic and now he's like kind of like, that's not, you know, central anymore, but they don't have him be like, oh.
There. This is Mark Ronson with his incredible new album, Late Night Feelings. Featuring the hit singles, Late Night Feelings and Nothing Breaks Like a Heart. Mark Ronson, Late Night Feelings, out Friday.
Oh, I'm like, I'm past this now.
Yeah, he is woke, guys, after that whole scene.
It's almost as if, so before, the alcohol was keeping him together.
Mm-hmm.
And now, once the like you said, shit gets real, the alcohol isn't enough. It's not going to do it for him. It's not the way out. And he has to realize that. So he's still an alcoholic, but he realizes that he's got other priorities, so to speak, like staying alive. And that scene where Luke is getting him drunk and everything, I really like that because it kind of established the idea that Luke didn't take him seriously.
Like you said, for sure.
Nobody took him seriously. And that underestimation is precisely why it's believable that he could get away in the first place. In the background, we know that he was some sort of activist, that he was in the shit for a while, and then he got out to go straight, kind of. So when he kicks that door and knocks that bicycle over, you're like, okay, you could see him. He'd have to fight. He's in a bar fight or whatever. You know what I mean? Like he had some instincts, right? That's a thing. It's not like coming out of nowhere. And then later, when he puts it together that Luke was actually the one who killed Julian, and it's time to go. That's one of those things where you realize that Luke's underestimation of him is coming to his advantage.
And then
right?
Theo, and like as they're escaping, Theo like pulls a starter or something from the other car.
Yes.
Like he does a thing that almost seems very natural to him that I think most people wouldn't really think about in a movie like this.
And you're like, in fact, when I was watching with my wife last night, she goes, "That was really smart. Yes. I would have never thought of that. Yes. I would have just kind of run away and hope they didn't know I was gone."
He did something
for
like
enough.
This before, like at some point. Mm-hmm. Like that's kind of what it's telling you. I also love how the movie paints how low at a point he is in his life because after they kidnap him the first time, and there's some discussions like do I need the money or anything when he's negotiating with Julian. They throw him out and they throw some change on the ground,
and he picks it up
because he has to,
because he still needs the money.
He needs it. And it's those little things that really build up this movie for me,
which also builds that motivation, like so it describes and gives foundation to his motivation, because really, would you want to get back in bed with terrorists and all this other stuff like that when you're just going on to get along? No, he needed the cash, which is why he picked that up. There's a lot of that foundation in his character, which is again goes back to Karan's whole thing where he's like not into the expository, so you're learning it as it kind of moves forward without anyone ever having to split out for you. You just have to watch for those details, which actually makes sense as to why you watch the movie a couple times a year. Because it may not be that you're getting all sorts of new information out of it, but there's several times when you saw it and you got new information over and over and over again. And that feeling is a good one.
Well, one thing, I mean, I've seen this movie so many goddamn times at this point, but one thing I noticed in that car scene, he's literally sitting in Julian's seat. You know, as they're heading back, like just those little things that actually means something. You know, it's not just, he was uncomfortable in the backseat. I think it kind of means a lot. But let's talk about the movie, like post the car chase, post woke Theo. I love the buildup of the fishes and kind of their resistance to everything and the arguments they're all having. In particular, like that, the argument of, okay, so he finds out that Key is pregnant in a beautifully realized scene too, like in a bar.
They're in a manger.
Yeah, in a manger for sure, or in a barn. But also, you could see it as like a Christian related thing. But also, cows, like in every culture, like Hindu culture, but many, many others, like they represent life. They represent fertility for sure. So it's not very subtle about the imagery. But I think somebody who isn't thinking about how this movie is working on multiple levels could miss that. But just a beautiful reveal of that whole thing. Then they are having this argument about what to do with the baby. What did you guys think of that scene? Because it always struck me as interesting that his first response is to go public, and the resistance just seems like that could never work.
This is a certain level of there's a certain privilege to this, right?
Yeah.
When I have one of my best men at my wedding, we talked about the goings on of, police and people getting shot and armed and all that stuff like that. And from his perspective, like, you got to trust the cops.
Right.
And from my perspective, I was like, I don't know about that. And one of the things that was interesting about that is that I'm later reading in the New York Times about how there are these communities of color, or not even of color, but of low socioeconomic status,
and their experience with the cops and public life is very different from that of people who are sort of more in the middle class, even if they're in lower middle class, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, there is a bit of a cultural divide with, hey, if you go public, if it's all out there, if it's all open, then no one can hurt you, as opposed to if you go public, then they will take your stuff from you. Right?
Yeah, for sure.
There's a kind of mentality. I have this myself, and I get it from my mother. It's kind of like, I'm not telling anyone that I'm about to put an offer on a house. When I get the house, I'll tell people. Because if I tell people before, something might happen. So this idea that he's in the system. His cousin is this big deal with the Michelangelo, and he's got a job.
It's an
and-
arc, by the way. I love that they called it an arc. I didn't notice that the first time, but it's an arc of like art, fine art.
Right, exactly. It's like a vault, and they're saving it. Mm-hmm. So he's got these connections to this big world. And he's like, if we go public, everything should be fine. They won't be able to get you. But on the other hand, the other guys are like, no, if we go public, they'll take the baby from her. And for Key, that's obviously a non-starter.
Yes.
Let's also just mention her name is Key. I mean, it's not spelled like a key, but she's really the key, right? So
I thought that was a little too much.
Like the boat called The Tomorrow. I mean,
yeah, The Tomorrow.
There's
certain
take the
bits key to tomorrow.
In this movie where he goes too far, but I love it anyway. That's fine.
Right.
But one
yes,
of the
this was,
also
was cool
that,
how he was able to say that. Mm-hmm.
That argument reminded me of, was, which I think is maybe a little bit less intentional, less about what that argument was about, was like that I think it is a sort of a traditional like Hollywood narrative of like once you reveal, if like for any sort of conspiracy story, once you reveal the truth, that like that'll like, you know, that solved the problem, right? And you know,
right.
like one of the first movies I saw Chiwetel Ejiofor in Serenity, like mm-hmm. that's sort
right.
of the crux of the film. And I think that certainly anyone who works in journalism this year, if you believe that that's how things worked, that belief got a lot of, abuse this year.
Right. There's a certain faith in the system that I think Theo, even though he's so like downtrodden, given the fact that he was able to live a middle class life and he's not actively fighting back, I guess he has a certain faith in those systems. But I don't know. I have to think that there may
there's
be
also a double. Mm-hmm. There's also a double. An ulterior motive there. So,
where
Luke is looking at it, he's like,
right. mm-hmm.
no, we can't tell the system. We can't bring it out to the system because he wants to use this
yeah.
child as his symbol of resistance and war and all that mm-hmm. stuff. Like, if you come to us, you know, we've got the future in our hands. And if you come to our side, we can make things better. I can get
well,
more power.
We'll swing back to that because that's definitely an important point of this whole film. But the thing about Theo that's interesting is just him bringing up the idea of bringing the baby to the authorities. I do think there's a way to do that, right? To make it public, to at least announce something without immediately making yourselves like open to the state. I think there's a way to do it to like start changing public minds. What's just funny is that, you know, if he didn't have to like immediately run, I think they actually could have like thought out some way to do that. Maybe hack some airwaves or something, like figure out a way to get that message out there that could change the public's minds and maybe not leave them in such a vulnerable spot. But yes, you're right. It turns out that Luke is double crossing and they want to use the baby for their own messaging. And we're never quite sure what. But I guess what's important about that whole thing is that he went to any means to do that, right? His impulse and his whole focus is on really supporting the fishes and the resistance and making the baby a symbol of that. And it seems less about protecting the baby, even. It's more mm-hmm. like using the baby as a tool, and that's immediately what Theo is trying to stop.
He doesn't care what's best for humanity. He
right,
cares what's
right.
best for the fishes, his faction.
Yes.
Although, I mean, I think that part of it is his argument would be that what's best for the fishes is what's best for humanity because it's
sure.
it's that logic of my side is the correct side. And
mm-hmm.
so anything, you know, that it's sort of a means to the end, which is, you know, the fishes sort of coming out ahead.
Mm-hmm. It's
sure.
a really smart commentary on like just liberal resistance in a way, too. Like, that may not always be the best response, especially if you're trying to, I don't know, change hearts and minds and not just trying to prolong a war or something like that. But yeah, so that scene happens. Theo decides to escape. In another great scene, by the way, because the whole escape sequence, very little goes right. It's such a
exactly.
wonderfully pretty sequence and mostly a long take too. Of them like trying to sneak out and push the car and just start.
He doesn't have any
car.
Shoes on.
He doesn't have any shoes on. There's a lot of imagery around his feet too.
Yep.
I've seen people theorize like that's almost like a saintly thing for him.
Yeah, it's like a John the Baptist kind of situation going on right there. Yeah,
yeah. They absolutely make a big deal of him like being barefoot and then finding shoes several times in the film. So, given Cuarón is a filmmaker coming from like a very, very prominent Catholic country. Yeah, I could see that being a thing.
Yeah, Mexicans have never been subtle about that kind of imagery.
That whole sequence, what I love about it too is that it's a modern problem. It's modern, like starting the car. They're in the future and they're still having a trouble like turning the car's ignition, which is kind of funny.
Right. The engine just won't turn over. He's got to do the pushing. He's got to do all this stuff. And you know what's really funny is that, to give you an idea of like the broke downness of this world and society, like today, if you own a car, like there are people I know who have 1996 Honda Civics still running at 200,000 miles, because the cars today are so incredibly reliable, right? So things have to get really broken before that happens. It could also be a commentary on English engineering. We all know Land Rovers and Jaguars have never had the best record. But at the same time, the fact that nothing goes right brings more attention to that scene. And again, you're on your seat, and you're on your seat about things that are kind of like, they're so mundane, but they're so important right then. It reminds you of the Von Trapp family trying to get the car out without making any noise, right? Then they're lucky that they're on this downhill situation. He turns the corner. All the speed is lost. Anyone who's ever snowboarded or skis knows what that's about. And he's got to push this thing, and he's got nothing on his feet. And, you know, it's just like there's just no way. It's
good
an impossible situation.
Good thing those dogs didn't actually attack him. Would I find funny
all the animals like him.
Yeah, the animals love him. That's another, like, potentially religious thing or tying him to nature or something. In this film, the animals in some way represent the innocence of children too. Like people, there are animals everywhere because we don't have kids anymore, and pets, as you and I know, Dwayne, do take the place of tiny humans. A little bit. We take care of them. We love them like children. There's one ad at the beginning of the film for like a dog fur coat, and I think Cuarón was saying like, oh, that would be kind of a joke, right? Like this is the ultimate end of capitalism, right? Is to basically start marketing to our pets. And that's way too real and way too true right now. I just bought
it's also an nod to the book, because in the book a lot of elements in the movie are not in the book. But one of the big elements in the book is that people have strollers for their animals. They dress them up in fine clothing, a lot of the you can imagine the visualizations you have from the Hunger Games in the Capitol on pets. So it's like a little subtle nod to that thing, because that's kind of how the world is, because capitalism still exists. And yes, that is the end of capitalism when you're sort of like, hey, I'll make money off the dog situation, you know? It's crazy.
It's crazy. And there's definitely a market for it in this film. I guess one thing about the technology, too, is it's also, there's so much old technology as well. Like, one of the things that brought Blade Runner to mind is that you see a lot of almost like rickshaws, right? Or you see those bicycles that are carrying people around early on in the film, or even maybe they're like motorized in a really simple way too. But technology isn't like 20 years ahead of when the film was released. Technology is like a little bit better than today, but still pretty shitty, you know, like very,
like the
very
cars, the snow stuff with the little like heads up display and stuff like that. But it's not like we're leaps forward. Right, it's not like we're in a place where you can like teleport to where you want to go. It's just people have basically hacked their way to making things work because resources are scant.
I think the thing that it does that both the Blade Runner, I think, was maybe the first one of the first films to do is that this idea that when the future happens, it doesn't replace everything else.
Right,
it's that there's like all these different levels of technology coexisting at the same time. And I think that's part of what makes this world feel really lived in, is that they have the futuristic stuff, and then they have the stuff that they, you know, the shitty stuff they haven't bothered to get rid of.
And I guess that also shows like just the stalling of innovation in society too, right? Because if all these things are happening, you know, climate change, major uprisings, warfare, nuclear warfare all over the place. One of the scariest headlines in that newspaper sequence, by the way, is Russia launching nukes. You know, like Russia starting everything by launching nukes. And it's like, after today and the Obama administration, you know, issuing sanctions against Russia, like all of this is beginning to seem a little too close to home. And this movie is getting
both
scarier.
Putin and Trump have called for kind of not restarting, but building on top of the existing nuclear weapon supply that both countries have. So both
that's
the U.S.
great,
and
guys.
And the U.S.
I'm just excited that living in the U.S., the bombs will fall on us first and we won't have to deal with the fallout. And death will be swift.
death will be swift unless it's nuclear fallout. I don't know. Like maybe we'll be on the outskirts. I don't know, guys. No.
If I see I'm gonna like run to the river and I'm gonna like just swim to Manhattan to get hit. You know, I don't want to survive that.
I see. We know where
wow, that is nihilistic stuff.
So dark, guys. But yeah, there's so much else. We're nearing our hour-long point, but there's so much else to discuss about this movie. Any particular points you guys want to bring up? I know one thing I keep seeing, whenever you say you love something on the internet, there will inevitably be somebody who comes up and is like, the thing you love is terrible for this and this yes. and this reason. And one thing I keep seeing about this movie is the idea that, you know, and it's a legitimate one too. It's like, this is essentially a white savior film. You know, Theo is like lone white dude who comes out of nowhere. And I think it was, I forget who tweeted this, but somebody was like, it was a, oh, look at this, multicultural resistance it fails. And this one white guy comes in and manages to like do the thing that they've been trying to do forever. I think that's a little unfair and, I don't know, disingenuous about how the film is actually portraying things. But you brought up some good points.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that for this particular film, the white savior complex isn't exactly accurate. Like that person said, there is a multicultural resistance, but I also feel as if, first of all, when you look at the movie, right, mm-hmm. versus the book, in the original storyline, Julian was the pregnant one. And in that case, you'd have this white woman being saved by a white man and yada, yada, yada. And maybe we wouldn't have that, this talk at all. But the decision to make Key, a person of African descent, she's a Ghanaian descended Briton. In order to the choice to make that happen, I think was one that actually energized the cast somewhat. You've got this, 19-year-old and she's got this pregnant thing going on. And what's interesting is that because of what we talked about earlier, this idea that it's not a question of one color winning over another color, right? It's the refugee situation. There's like an old German woman in there next to some people of, Arabic descent, all this stuff. It's really not a question of what people look like. In fact, there's plenty of shots, at least one that I can recall, of a whole bunch of dark-skinned black men in like suits and everything walking around, right, as he's about to get abducted and go meet the Fishers. So he's saving this person, but there's a certain level of post-racialness that's happening in this entire scenario. No one bats an eye that Luke is now the leader or that Julian, a woman, was the leader before. So it's not like we live in a world where you can only be doing the righteous thing if you're a white person, because the Fishers are clearly righteous, even though they're on the wrong side of the antagonist-protagonist divide for us. but at the same time, you've got your most ardent villainous Fisher is your dreadlocked white guy. He just wants to kill everybody. And so I guess
Charlie
Hunnam,
like, by the way, Anthony, his right. mind was blown learning that was Charlie Hunnam, and I love
that
actor.
That's amazing.
Just insane. But he'll be back in the next Pacific Rim. So that's weird seeing that guy who is a hero in a lot of things, and an anti-hero in like Sons of Anarchy, as like the real bad resistance fighter.
Right.
The last thing I wanted to say was just that. Mm-hmm. So I feel like what we have in the story is something is a complex mix of different types of people in a world that's not divided specifically by race, but by class and by status, legal status. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that he takes on the at first you think it's the father figure, but by the time we see them in the boat together, it's kind of Jesus marrying Joseph, right?
Yeah,
he's the guy in charge of the family, even though he's not responsible for having created the baby. It's less of a white savior and more of a I'm going to take my privilege and use it responsibly. Mm-hmm. And that happens. So I don't think that's what defines this movie. If you're looking at the film and you're saying I got to throw it out because of that, this is no Gangster's Paradise, I guess is what I'm saying.
I completely agree that like in the text of the film that mostly I don't think that's really what the film is about. And certainly I wouldn't dismiss the film for that reason. I do think that there is this sort of, just the pure visual of like when, Key aside, who's sort of, I think, a special case because she's the one being saved, basically, all the good Fishes, that is, Julianne Moore, Clive Owen, and then the, I don't remember the actress or character name of the midwife, right, are basically the good ones. And
Miriam,
then,
yeah.
Yeah, Miriam. And then Luke, and then his, the person who seems to be his right-hand man is also, a brown man. Mm-hmm. There's something kind of unfortunate about seeing things kind of break down that way. So I think that even if I don't think that was intentional, but I think there is sort of like some unfortunate optics there.
I do think
I mean, it's also, I think the politics of that are also interesting from the sense of like this idea that I think that you were talking about earlier, Devendra, about, you know, this idea of even the resistance is corrupt, which I think is totally, I think, a good note of ambiguity to strike. But then in some ways, the film kind of like begs out of that, because then it says, okay, well, then there's this other salvation in, you know, the human project. Mm-hmm. Whereas, I mean, if we really want to draw direct parallels, like with the political situation now, like, is it better to say, well, like both of these sides are kind of screwed up in their own, are both screwed up, and so I wash my hands of them? Or is it better to say, well, they're both screwed up, but one of them is like right in a lot of ways, and so I'm still going to cast my lot with them, even if I think they do a lot of unsavory things. So
I think you described every Trump voter in a way too. So I don't know,
right?
Or every Bernie or bust people fall under the same umbrella.
Yeah.
But like, you know, I think like, and then that's, so I think that's like an interesting, like, I'm always a little bit wary. I mean, and then having that also then the like the militant, you know, let's say leftist group, maybe a little simplistic, but so the militant leftist group, and then to have, which is, you know, again, led by, you know, a black man, and then have the white guy be like, I don't know, the reasonable thing is neither of these. I mean, it makes me a little bit uneasy. I don't, it doesn't make me, you know, toss out the film, but I think that it gives you a little bit more to chew on there.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's also remember that Sid is a bad guy, and he's as white as the new driven snow, right? he kind of comes up as normal. Then we've got the lady, I mean, she may be white, but she's also got this immigrant thing. She doesn't even speak English.
Well,
Michaela,
she's a gypsy,
right?
So
she's a Roma, and she's from a,
and they've
an
always been the underclass
and marginalized
in Europe. Like, yeah,
exactly.
Generally,
she's a traditionally marginalized person, and they're known for being petty and taking what they can. This is the stereotype: they're petty, they take what they can when they can. So the idea of this woman having this baby, she could have exploited it, and you get a hint of that when she gets out of that closed door
with
the baby. And then you're like, oh my God, she shook the baby. And then she comes back and helps Key get through the door. And you're like, oh my God. And then she does all this incredible stuff. They can't get out of that place without her,
and
right?
They can't even speak the same language, but it's the language of survival, right? And, oh, exactly. You have the one thing that will save civilization. I should probably do what I can to help you right now.
She does the right thing, and she does it. And despite the fact, I mean, and so I guess what I'm saying is, yes, you kind of have these like English speaking, you know, Caucasian people that are great, but then you have Caucasian people that are pretty terrible. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you've got Sid as a bad guy, you've got your dreadlock friend, and questionably, you've got the cousin who's got all the art locked up in his vault.
Oh yeah,
and then you've got these people who are marginalized that are also helping, like you know, the gypsy lady, and obviously Key is a good person, although she's being saved. But I guess what I'm saying is that the world is just a bit more complex here. So I do see what Anthony's saying when it comes to the visuals. But the best part about this movie is that it forces you to pay attention, and once you do, you recognize that it's deeper than that kind of thing.
I have to say, I think symbolically, I'm always for trying to get as many people of color in leads in films. If anybody, you know, slash filmcast listeners will understand this, I am always bringing this up because it's a constant topic of conversation. I would have rather seen Chiwetel Ejiofor be, you know, the lead in The Martian instead of Matt Damon, because how many times do we have to save Matt Damon, for God's sake?
But, well, you know what's funny about him? He did play a Hindu in that movie, which is not the kind of thing that you typically
and
play.
That was, I actually found that really interesting, too, because I have cousins who look like him. Like, I have cousins who, you know, are half Indian
look
and
like,
half black.
Yeah, look like me, yeah.
Yeah, and look like Dwayne. Dwayne is also from Guyana, my home country, and you're an interesting mixture of ethnicities, too. So always good to have your perspective, Dwayne. what I was trying to say about Theo, though, it's the imagery of like this, this white British dude who is almost seems like an everyman in a way too, right? He rises up, he recognizes that he has to do something, and helps this, you know, this Fuji who has no rights, no anything, but recognizes that they need help and that helping them will be an important thing for the rest of humanity too. So I think that imagery that's kind of how Cuarón's movies seem to work too. Like, he's a very symbolic guy, sometimes to the detriment of the film, I think. As much as I
like
love Gravity. Yeah, Gravity.
Yeah,
like, there's exactly. a lot of like birth imagery. There's a lot of like stuff there that maybe is a little too overt, but I love that movie too. I just think, and the fact that it's Cuarón making this film, a Mexican filmmaker, I think gives it another level of, it's at least depth. Not as like, yeah, it's more racially deep, I think, than just dismissing it as white savior thing. So I just wanted to put that out
there's
there.
Also the fact that normally white saviors do so at like very little cost, like Michelle Pfeiffer walks away and she can go back to her life, you know, at any given time they can just drop everything and walk away. But he, you know, Theo gives up his status, he becomes a refugee, there's no way for him to easily get back from that. And then after it's all said and done, you know, whether he's just passed out or he completely loses his life, we don't know, but there is cost to what he's done. Yeah, I mean, I like to believe he's dead. I like to believe he's dead, but I also know Hollywood likes to come back. So
Hollywood loves to come back. Well, honestly, there's a lot of rich material, and it would be interesting to see them bring back this story in a certain way, maybe in the way that like City of God was brought back. City of God was originally a TV series, and then it was turned into a movie, and then there was like a sequel series as well. I could see a sequel about like humanity trying to restore itself, definitely without Clive Owen. But I would love to know what's going on at the Human Project. Like, I'm sure Ki is not the only woman who is having a child, and it'll probably be a multicultural bunch of women who they're, you know, kind of helping to protect, who are finally getting pregnant and figuring out what's happening. I don't know if that's even important. The film definitely stands on its own. But I guess more importantly, like, what are your takeaways from the film watching it at the end of 2016? Definitely one of the hardest years for many, many reasons. As I was watching this, the news that Debbie Reynolds passed away came across my screen. So that was great.
Yeah,
it's a tough year. What do you take away from this film now?
I'll say like one of my big takeaways, which is maybe not a hopeful note to end this on, but was that, you know, one of the things I wrestled with a lot was, you know, that this idea that there's all this like shitty stuff happening in the film, and then on top of that, people are infertile, and that and there's even that line which says we were done even before that happened. And I think like for a while I wasn't really sure. I was like, oh, is that sort of like almost like gilding the lily? Is it too much? Like, what if they just made a film about all the shitty things that are happening to us now, and they didn't have to add this sort of high concept? And I think watching it now in 2016, I realized that to me it's actually perfect, because one of the things I really like was struggling to try to articulate after the election was just this feeling of like that the future was going in one direction, and suddenly that future has sort of gone away. And I mean, I think in some ways that's sort of I think it's hard to overstate how bad things could potentially get, but I think I was also responding to it on this sort of very emotional level. And I think that Children of Men really speaks to that, that's like that idea of like, how do you live your life when you feel like there is no future? And I mean, in that sense, like the concept is really great. And I mean, obviously the execution really follows through and makes you feel that.
Yeah, I think for me, I would agree with much of what Anthony said, especially about how do you live your life when there is no future. A lot of what we do as humans is focused on what we'll leave behind, because there's a moment, you know, sometime in your 30s perhaps, when you realize that you might be on the downside of time now, right?
Too real.
No.
Right. And, well, it's just interesting because, you know, Clive Owen in this stage, he must be in his 40s, right? And during the filming of this. And as you watch it, it's like he doesn't care about anything. He doesn't really know why he's there. He needs some money so he can live his lifestyle. And once he realizes that she's pregnant, and once she lets him know that Julian is the one that told her to trust him above everybody else, he realizes he has a thing to do. He's got something to do that can save the world. Mm-hmm. And not everybody's presented with that opportunity. And he actually rises to that occasion, which is what we want all of our heroes to do. And so for me watching it, I mean, I'll tell you this. After 10 years, I've seen the movie a few times. I own the Blockbuster video DVD sale version, $9.99 with the Blockbuster container. And I've seen the movie multiple times, but I think every time I watch it, I find myself getting emotional. I find myself tearing up, which is probably one of the reasons why it's in my top five, because not many films do that for me. And that idea of like, what do you do Like, what's the point if humanity is on its way out, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what are you leaving behind? It's a question that I can't answer. Luckily, we're not in that position now. But at this age, I'm also thinking about my own fertility, like, you know, starting a family, things like that. And so that it becomes like, what am I doing for those who are going to come after me? So, like, politics aside, I think there's a very human element to this, especially as you watch it over time. Mm-hmm. And that's I got to give, you know, more kudos to Quran for being able to pull that off in a static, relatively static format, right? This movie.
It's really hard to convey true hopelessness, I guess, without seeming like you're going overboard. And I remember when this movie came out, and even to this day, like, a lot of people are like, they can't even buy into the premise, right? That this is a world where people can't have kids anymore. And look at this magical baby.
Welcome to science fiction.
Yeah, yeah. And look at this baby at the end, this magical baby that makes everybody stop, which, by the way, is the most cynical way to view that wonderful, beautiful scene of them walking through the building with the baby. Yeah, maybe it's a little too hopeful, but that's the way I like my hopeless cinema, or my hopeless science fiction. It's like that tinge of hope, that moment of, like, maybe it'll be okay, and then it immediately goes to shit again. But yeah, it's that sort of thing. It's everything you guys have been saying. I think this film says a lot about trying to survive in a hopeless world. But the world is even more hopeless, not to get too real. Also, it is a lot more hopeless today than it was a decade ago. There across the world, there have been huge conservative movements, huge isolationist movements. We have the refugee crisis happening all across the world, but especially centered in Europe and around the Middle East. We know that there are going to be huge environmental issues. At Christmas this year, it was like nearly 60 degrees in New York. And, like, things, it's hard to attribute even single days to overall climate change, but things are getting weird, you know? So we're seeing that. We're seeing the major storms like Sandy as well, and how that flooded New York and the major impact that had. Like, we still have to close lines and fix tunnels from the damage from that whole thing. It is all a little much. It's a little hard.
It's a little
to
take. Bleak, but it's there's still some hope left. Like, I mean, let's just to put a tiny bit of hope. When the Colombian legislature passed their post-referendum laws that made peace with the FARC, for the first time since Columbus landed in America, we've had peace in the Western Hemisphere. That's like a huge chunk of the world with no war.
Although there are huge issues around that still. So
there was long and short of it is,
yeah,
they put up the piece for a referendum. The referendum failed. They put up the piece again for the parliament to decide upon. They changed it to match what the people had complained about. The parliament passed it, and the piece is now standing. It's a real legal thing. And because of that, there's no, you know, state on state or civil war violence happening in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, but just as we move on from civil war, which is definitely that's an important thing to consider. Mm-hmm. You have the unseen, almost like a resurgence of the Cold War, except it's not really cold. It's just invisible, and it's in the cyber, and it's terrifying.
No, you're right.
Yeah, because it's influencing everything. I guess I also read Trump's statement about the computer world, and it just made me really sad for where we're headed. But the point of this film, and what I still love about it, and why I'll keep watching it, is that idea of hope. It's not just one person making a difference, but it's the idea of, you know, stepping up. When you see an opportunity, it's not just like sitting back and like being complacent about the world turning to shit. Like, we will all have our own opportunities to kind of do something about what's happening, either maybe speaking up in your job or your field. It's honestly something I'm thinking about now as I write for a site that's read by, you know, millions of people.
You have a platform.
Yeah, it kind of changes my coverage a little. Dwayne, I'm also in your camp of, like, you know, I have to start thinking about having kids. And there's a lot of talk I'm hearing from people who are worried about raising kids in the Trump world. And I think this movie, in a way, made me feel... I've had those fears too, and this movie made me feel less fearful because you need to have those kids. Those kids represent hope, and the only way, like, yeah, we will paint a better future is by, you know, also having those kids and teaching them, you know, a worldview that is maybe different than what's being portrayed in the wider government or something. But also, if you feel afraid and you stop doing that thing, it could end up being like an idiocracy situation where everybody else started procreating and we're going to be outnumbered with different sorts of, I don't know, mindsets. Not to, I guess it's a little dark, but I'm trying to bring hopeful guys.
So you're just saying procreate and have fun doing it.
Procreate, have fun doing it. Procreate with a purpose, everyone. But also, that's your new pickup line, everybody.
Look them right in the eyes and say, this is for the world.
This is for, come with me if you want to save the future. And you can read that line in multiple ways. But also the whole thing about raising kids, too. I think it's what I love about this movie, the idea of a world without children is essentially saying it's a world without hope, right? Because if you have no children, you have no future. It's basic math. That's why I love that scene of them going to the elementary school. And it's just a ghost. It's abandoned. It's a ghost town. Because why would you even need to maintain something like that when there aren't any kids around? And
you see Key sitting on the swing, and she's swinging, and you realize that she's barely more than a child herself.
But yes, and then you have this one child come up, and this one kid represents all the hope. And it's a reminder that, yeah, there's still something worth fighting for. So that'll always be my takeaway from this movie.
A baby was powerful. I mean, there's that scene you mentioned. Like, you've got this baby's cries, and it's the most vulnerable being on the face of the earth, and it's effectively able to stop an army for a good half a minute.
Yeah,
just by crying, right? They can't even be beside themselves, and if that doesn't give you hope, nothing will.
Agreed. Any other thoughts about the film, guys? Because we've been going on for a while. I love this movie so much; I could talk about it endlessly, and I don't know. I hope we'll have more takes on it as well. Like the last version, it's a really early Blu-ray. So it was released like close to the advent of the Blu-ray format. You even get the notice when you boot it up saying, hey, this is a new format. There may be some bugs. Be sure to update your Blu-ray player when you put in this disc. I found that kind of hilarious. I'd love to see a 4K version at some point, maybe HDR as well. I saw this movie on my projector, and I also feel like seeing it on a big-ass screen is the only way to see this movie, because that really lets you envelop yourself in the background and in everything going on. Like, sit back and pause that scene where Theo is in the newspaper-covered walls, and it's pretty incredible to watch. So, yeah, anything else, guys?
I would just say that if anyone hasn't revisited it for a while, it's also worth noting that it's currently on HBO Go/Now.
There you go.
Yeah. It was fantastic to be able to talk to people about this. I mean, it's a great film.
Excellent. Okay, so where can we find you guys on the internet? And thank you for joining, by the way. Anthony, go ahead.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. This has been super fun. I am at Anthony Ha on Twitter. I write for TechCrunch.com. And you can also buy a chapbook of my short stories called Love Songs for Monsters at Amazon.
And Dwayne?
You can check me out on Twitter. I'm twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DWAYNED. I write for Geeks of Doom in my spare time. You can also check me out on my own blog. It's DwayneD.com.
All right. And I'm at Devendra on Twitter. I write about TechAndGadget.com. We're doing the podcast there. As always, thank you for listening to us. Leave a review for the Slash Filmcast on iTunes. Tell your friends, subscribe, and keep an eye out for our top 10 films of 2016 coming soon. Thanks for joining us, folks. If you thought things had changed, friend, you better think again. Put the pot in the fewest of words. Counts are still running the world. Counts are still running the world.